I'm Dan Meisner, and this is Work in Progress, a show about the meaning and identity we find in work. From Slack. This week, stories of people whose work and lives are deeply rooted in the past, but are focused on the future. Coming up, we'll hear how one woman's family history inspired her to push for immigration reform. But we start with producer Lily Ames, who visited one of the UK's oldest universities to meet a man with a thoroughly modern job title.
So we're in a reading room in the Bodleian Library now, and there's books all over the shelves, but it's really only a tiny sliver of what the Bodleian has. The Bodleian has millions of books. There's a couple of times when going around libraries when I've had what I call the shiver, when I feel connected to the past. One time was being shown a copy of Darwin's Descent of Man, signed by the author, signed by Darwin.
Martin Poulter landed his dream job. He gets to spend his days hunting down obscure information in the libraries of Oxford. He's looking for those did-you-know facts, the kind of information that turns heads at cocktail parties. Like how one of the most popular scientists of the 1800s was a woman named Mary Somerville.
She was like the Carl Sagan of her time. She was the great popularizer of science. And she was a mathematician, but also wrote about the solar system and how it works. And she had a great kind of best-selling book at that time, which was a popular science book. And her archives are here. They're in this building.
When he does this kind of research for Oxford, it doesn't go into an academic journal. Instead, it's going online, in Wikipedia. Martin is Oxford's very own Wikimedian in residence.
So a Wikipedian in residence would be someone focused on improving Wikipedia articles. Being a Wikimedian in residence includes that, but also about sharing data, sharing text, sharing images, illustrating Wikipedia articles. Sharing material enables people to create free educational stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Martin is the first to get paid by Oxford to act as an ambassador for Wikipedia. And it's no surprise he got the job. He really was the ideal candidate. You should see this guy's wiki CV. He started off his career as an academic. He's got a PhD in philosophy of science. But his proudest academic moments come from making valuable edits on Wikipedia. His entries have made it to the front page of the site, getting over 5 million hits per day. He's even worked on huge page entries, like Brexit.
I did agonize about how should I spend all my time doing this? Could I affect the vote in some way? And I spent some time doing it the month before and putting in expert opinion, including putting in opinions I disagreed with or I didn't think you've got to edit in a neutral way. And I put in some materials that was pro and some against Brexit, but I put in the expert position, which is what Wikipedia is supposed to represent, and the experts were overwhelmingly saying it was a terrible thing.
For those of you who are just casual users of Wikipedia, you may not have noticed that the online encyclopedia has been on a major push to change its reputation.
It's unfortunate it calls itself the encyclopedia anyone can edit. That gives this kind of Wild West image that anybody goes in and throws whatever they think, and then the average of that is what the article is. Actually, it evolves. So people come in with different possible statements about something, and then we look to the source.
This is where Oxford comes in. They've been running the trusted source of information game since the year 1096. It's the oldest university in the English-speaking world, and that makes them trusted, but it also makes them more than a little stubborn. They've been doing their thing for centuries, and in marches Martin, suggesting they make their information and research accessible to everyone online. He's got his work cut out for him, but he's got his introductory line down pat.
Definitely, and I'll say, I'm from Wikipedia. We're summarizing the total of human knowledge and culture and sharing it with the world for free. What part do you want to play in that? And it's a big picture, potentially inspiring thing or frightening, and people react in different ways.
And whenever he feels overwhelmed by the task at hand, He turns to history for inspiration.
When I started work at the Bodleian, I learned that hundreds of years ago, they used to actually chain the books to the shelves with metal chains. And it made it really difficult. You could only be 3 feet away from the shelf to read your book. You couldn't take it to the window. There was no electric light. You couldn't have candles. So it was winter and you couldn't get your book to the window. Tough. Chaining up the books didn't stop people stealing pages from them. So I see what I'm doing now as equivalent to that, that I'm taking away the chains of restrictions on knowledge and art and sharing those, and people can use them for their intended purpose.
Now it's the physical books that end up being the most exciting part of this whole online adventure.
Now my job is related to the most rare and precious things, the globally unique things that the Bodleian has. I was in someone's office and looked at this massive, ornate book on their shelf and asked, what that? And it was an early Bible. And we looked at the date and it was 1520. Now it's my job to connect some of that to the outside world and let the outside world hear about it.
Work in Progress is an original series from Slack. Slack is where work happens, at places like the online sports retailer Fanatics and Capello's, which makes gluten-free, grain-free pasta. More on them at the end of the show. Check us out at slack.com/podcast or tweet us at Slack Stories. A minute ago, we met Martin Poulter, Oxford's Wikimedian in Residence, which is a job that simply didn't exist just a few years ago. In that sense, it's a pretty new type of work. And at the same time, Martin's work is steeped in history. He simply couldn't do this kind of job without centuries of academics who came before him. Every day, he stands on the shoulders of giants. Our next story is about that relationship between the past and the future, too. But it's not about the past of a famous academic institution. It's about personal history, family history, and how that inspired one woman's quest to reform American immigration policy. Producer Mio Edelman has the story, and it begins in a very unlikely place.
This is a story about the American dream. It starts on a football field.
To this day, I do not understand football.
My name is Yvonne Padilla Rodriguez.
On this day in 2011, Yvonne Padilla Rodriguez, a freshman at the University of Nevada, Reno, is at a football game.
I was at the SEC Championship in Atlanta, Georgia, at the Georgia Dome.
Lines up on the 10-yard line. The last one went into the end zone. Onside kick.
Yes.
A huge college bowl game. The LSU Tigers versus the Georgia Bulldogs.
It was obviously very loud because there were thousands of people in the stands, and then there were millions of people watching on national TV.
But Yvonne doesn't particularly care about this game. She's there to play another one at halftime, a contest she'd entered on the back of a Dr. Pepper bottle.
You had 30 seconds to throw as many footballs as you could into an oversized can of Dr. Pepper.
And the prize?
$100,000 in scholarship money.
What?
$100,000.
Okay, let's do this.
Let's introduce our contestants now. Caitlin Watson from Alabama and Yvonne Padilla Rodriguez from Las Vegas. And let me start with you, Yvonne. How did you prepare for this today?
And right before we actually started, we got interviewed by a reporter on national TV.
Get in your positions.
So then they let us kind of go to our stations. We get behind the line that was set up for us.
Are we set?
Now, $100,000 is a lot of money for anybody.
I had $90 in my bank account.
But Yvonne really needed that money.
I don't think a lot of people understood or really even knew that not too long before then, I was thinking about quitting college because I didn't have enough money. And I had also just recently been homeless.
Homeless?
As someone who grew up in a mixed status family, I might have been a full U.S. citizen, but I live the reality of being an undocumented person alongside my parents.
Yvonne is an American citizen. She was born in Los Angeles. Then she moved to Las Vegas as a teenager.
Both of my parents are immigrants from Guadalajara, Jalisco in Mexico. They came here in the 80s and the 90s on tourist visas that they overstayed.
Yvonne's father had arrived in time to qualify for amnesty under the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, but her mother was an undocumented immigrant until 2008.
He refused to petition her until later because the tensions of being a mixed status family made it so that my parents had a lot of issues between them.
And these are some of the tensions of growing up in a mixed status family.
I actually grew up most of my childhood without medical insurance. We didn't have access to anything, so we didn't go to the doctor. I didn't go to the dentist for the first time until I went to college. I was worried a lot that my mom was going to be deported. I was also worried that she might be swept up in a workplace raid. So we moved every 3 years. I never really got a really strong sense of home or permanence, for that matter, throughout my childhood.
Not that there was a lot of time to be a child.
So when I was growing up, I was everything for my parents. I was their translator, their accountant, their secretary, because I was U.S. citizen born. I was the adult in my family. I was toppling an age hierarchy.
And there was the poverty.
My mom actually had to work with somebody else's social security number. You work under the table. You don't work for minimum wage. My father was unemployed constantly. We couldn't pay our bills. So sometimes I came home and we didn't have light or running water. It was incredibly difficult to do my homework growing up. My parents were always getting into fights. Eventually, my parents' problems escalated to the point where my father told my mother and me that we should leave the house.
And then all of a sudden, Yvonne was homeless.
I was homeless. That was the only time in my life in which I was suicidal.
Seeking help wasn't an option.
I didn't tell anyone. I think I was still pretty afraid. I also grew up in such a way that we feared authority. And so I revealed very little about my personal life.
An American citizen living in the U.S. is unable to access the basic necessities of life and doesn't feel comfortable asking for assistance. What do you do then?
Part of my strategy for coping with the homelessness was to buy a few more hours of stability at school. So I did that through after school theater, actually, because that's where I was able to visualize alternative roles and futures for my life, because I was literally playing them out on stage.
The classroom also helped, especially history classes.
I was learning about history that contextualized my parents' story of immigration. And so that also kind of helped me visualize a sense of faith and hope that I could access the kind of social mobility that was denied to my parents because other people had done it historically.
This immersion in her studies helped Yvonne somehow survive high school. She even became valedictorian and eventually enrolled in the most affordable college program she could find, the University of Nevada, Reno, where, as a freshman, desperately seeking a scholarship, Yvonne picked up that bottle of Dr. Pepper.
I had never thrown a football in my entire life.
Yvonne is 5'2" and very petite.
My hand was substantially smaller than the ball.
And that's a major problem if you want to win a football throwing contest. But Yvonne found out the college's starting quarterback was in her theater class.
He was very generous, came out with me for a few hours, taught me form, how to most effectively get these balls into the hole, and that's how I prepared.
Yvonne has been practicing for this contest like crazy.
I would go to our football field and I would stack trash cans on each other that would kind of resemble the oversized can of Dr. Pepper, and I would throw as many balls as I could within the time frame up until it got dark.
And here we go again.
the crowds had kind of disappeared, even from my peripheral vision. I was totally focused on the target and getting as many of these balls in there. I had toned down in my head the sound of the crowd. I thought about myself as a professional football player.
Yvonne jumps out to the lead. She's totally going for it.
Clearly, I have nothing to lose and I have books to pay for.
But then, Caitlin claws back.
Caitlin with 10 now. One separating them. And we have a winner!
I didn't exit my role as a professional football player in my mind until I heard the second whistle ending the game.
Yvonne Padilla Rodriguez with 13 balls and congratulations.
Reporters rushed to me and a bunch of cheerleaders with these huge smiles started to crowd around me.
On behalf of Dr. Pepper, I'm pleased to present you with this check for $100,000 to go towards your tuition. Congratulations.
And I remember pausing for a long time after they asked me what this meant to me, and I just blurted out,
Dr. Pepper is seriously the best thing that has ever happened to me.
In a single moment, Yvonne's world has changed.
So, I mean, that money totally changed my life. It allowed me to go to school without having to worry about the financial burden.
After going without for her whole life, she can do anything she wants. But Yvonne makes a more meaningful choice.
I realized, too, that I would then have the opportunity to help other people from situations like the one that I lived, either because they're in mixed status families or because they're undocumented.
This decision to help makes sense. Things are pretty bad for undocumented and mixed status families. But remember, this is 2011. Nobody could have expected what was to come in 2017.
When I was in high school, it was just the interest that was sparked, and that's why I decided to major in history when I got to college.
After winning the contest, Yvonne returns to the University of Nevada, Reno.
But it wasn't until I started to conduct research and I started to find parallels between historical instances of migration and current ones that I really felt like I could find solutions to contemporary problems by consulting the past.
Armed with this research, in 2013, Yvonne enters another contest. This time, it's academic, no footballs. She's chosen, along with other students, to present her work to members of Congress.
Among all of these students, I was actually the only one who had done a project on immigration.
Yvonne flies to Washington to speak to Congress.
Even if Republicans were totally ideologically opposed to what I was saying, I was hoping that the fact that I had actually conducted empirical research on this would help to sway them rather than, say, using like emotional arguments or something. I think they were fairly attentive and would ask questions. But afterwards, it was very frustrating when publicly they would make votes on an immigration reform that would stall its implementation. So, I mean, in person, they were very polite.
Nonetheless, this was a turning point for Yvonne.
I was never expected to end up in the halls of Congress actually making a contribution to the immigration policy debate at the national level based on my own research. I saw myself taking part in a process that went beyond just my personal family story, but having the potential to impact the lives of millions in this country, that's why I felt empowered.
That sense of empowerment has followed Yvonne to New York.
I'm currently a history PhD student at Columbia University. My research focuses on 20th century immigration and labor policies and histories of childhood.
But she's arrived at a critical time for immigration in the U.S. You could say it's out of the frying pan and into the fire for Yvonne.
¿Me puedes decir de qué país eres? Yo soy de Honduras.
And I also work with unaccompanied child minors from Central America who don't have legal representation.
She does this at a pro bono legal services center for youth.
So I do a lot of translation and I interview kids who are in removal proceedings. And then I assess their cases for either asylum or special immigrant juvenile status or any other kind of legal relief that they might be eligible for.
This teenage girl tells Yvonne about her harrowing two-month journey from Central America and her arrest by immigration authorities.
They come to the U.S. either in a car, on a bus, sometimes on foot, and they're guided by human traffickers known as coyotes.
The girl came here to reunite with a family member who could sponsor her, but she spent months in a detention center nicknamed La Hielera, which translates as the icebox. Then she moved to a series of shelters.
We're pretty successful at being able to retain them here in the U.S. because a lot of these kids do actually have claims to legal status or to staying in this country, either because they are being persecuted in their home countries or because they have been abandoned, abused, or neglected. It could be a variety of things.
But it took the girl a while to find the lawyers here. Others were unwilling to take her case.
This hour, fear grips immigrant communities in the U.S. as federal agents arrest hundreds across the country in a number of raids.
In recent months, this legal clinic is getting really busy.
There have been a lot more cases in court. Even just today, there were like 40 unrepresented kids. The feel is much more different than it was before this new administration took office. There are a lot of these kids, the family members that they come to reunite with are also undocumented. And so some of these parents or family members are unwilling to even come into the building because they're so afraid of being arrested in court. I mean, the fear is pervasive.
Sometimes it can be overwhelming for Yvonne.
I once met a kid who I think it was from El Salvador, and through the interview process, you have to ask them to sign various understandings, that it's confidential, and this kid looked at me very confused and said, I can't sign my name, because he was illiterate, and he was 17 years old, and he had worked most of his life in agricultural fields from the time he was like 13. He was working like 80 hours a week in the fields, with pesticides, with very dangerous materials, constantly injuring himself. And those stories are emotionally very taxing to deal with on a weekly basis.
But as Yvonne works towards her ultimate goal,
long term, I want to work for the federal government improving policymaking at that level.
It is these sometimes overwhelming stories from the unaccompanied minors that inspire her.
I come to realize that they have so much capacity to overcome an immense amount of obstacles and adversity that I think even I couldn't imagine having to undertake, that I have some semblance of hope for future generations of immigrants in this country, that we have so much emotional resilience and motivation to better our lives, the lives of our families, and contribute to this society in meaningful and important ways, that I become that much more motivated for my own professional career so that I can continue to support these people and enhance their standard of living.
Work in Progress is an original series from Slack. Slack is where work happens, at places like Capello's, which makes gluten-free, grain-free pasta. Here's how they use Slack.
Hey, all. I'm Jeff Fierberg. I am the creative director for Capello's gluten-free, grain-free food. We make grain-free pasta, pizza, and cookie doughs. Slack has been instrumental to moving us forward. Our ability to, in one location, not only chat day to day, but also have it be a repository of meeting notes and a constant source of that communication has been huge for us. We've also managed to tie all of our other processes into it using different automation factors. So Slack has really become that one-stop shop for anything from requesting vacation time off to seeing what meeting notes you may have missed on vacation or taking a sick day. Within 3 days, your entire team will use Slack and they'll never look back. It's the fastest way to get everybody talking together and collaboratively, and it is the most open source product that I've ever worked with that does that. The ability to tie in integrations from workflow managers to Giphy not only make it a really productive tool, but also a fun one for your team as well. I'm so happy to use it day in and day out everywhere I work. That's it. Have a good Tuesday, guys. Bye.
To find out more about Slack or to get in touch, visit us. We're at slack.com/podcast or tweet us @SlackStories. I'm Dan Meisner. Thanks for listening.